Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Movie Mentors. I'm your host, Jeremy Boros, and today our incredible mentor is the award-winning producer, Molly Asher. Over the last several years, Molly has been shepherding some of the most beautiful, unique, and underheard stories to the big screen. Her collaboration with filmmaker Chloe Zhao brought us the mesmerizing Songs My Brothers Taught Me and the breathtaking film The Rider, which won the top prize at Cannes and Best Feature at the 2018 Gotham Awards. From Sundance and Tribeca to South by Southwest and Cannes, there's hardly a top-tier festival that Molly hasn't played. She recently won the prestigious Film Independent Producer Award and is currently in post-production on Nomadland, starring Frances McDormand. With her vast knowledge and extraordinary eye for great directors and material, it's no wonder that Molly is the best in the biz. So let's find out more with Molly Asher. Molly Asher, it's so wonderful to see you. Thank you for being here today. Yeah, you've had a lot of exciting things going on, especially in the last few years. Some crazy good award-winning films that we're going to talk about. I like to just start a little bit general and ask, what do you think makes a great producer?
As someone who is both basically uses their right and their left brain, so can think creatively, but can also think strategically, a listener, someone basically who's also a good psychologist, a good manager and psychologist.
Yeah. Do you have a background in any of that as well?
I do not, no.
No. But you did study theater at NYU, right?
I did, yes. Musical theater.
Oh, wow. Okay. What was that process like for you, that experience?
It was good. I mean, I like sang and danced all my life, so always assumed I wanted to be on Broadway. And then I went to Cap 21 at NYU and then discovered that I hated it, but I found that I loved theater. So then I went to straight theater.
And so what sort of transitioned you away from acting into producing?
I think wanting to have more control over my career and my life. I felt like, you know, going to auditions, it just always felt like I was trying to please other people, and I didn't really enjoy being in that kind of relationship. Mm-hmm. I was also waiting tables, and so it's a very similar feeling there.
Yeah, but I feel like maybe to what you said at the beginning, being an actor is getting into other people's heads, you know, understanding a room and circumstances. So do you feel that your acting probably has made you a great producer as well?
Yeah, I definitely think it's influenced it. And also with script development, I think that having an acting background gives you a sense of looking at a script from the character point of view.
After you transferred, or no, I'm sorry, you applied and you got into the master's program mm-hmm. at Tisch did you focus on producing from the get-go? Or
No, I did it all, and that's kind of, there was an opportunity to, they have a dual degree program where you can get an MBA from Stern and an MFA from Tisch. When I went there, they didn't have that yet, but they were looking for people to be a guinea pig for that. And they asked me if I would be interested in my interview. And I said no, because I, you know, wanted to explore other than just producing. But, you know, I also was like, I'm going to grad school to make connections and to meet my people, basically. And if I spend the first year at Stern, I'm going to miss that, like, very, very important first year where everyone starts to get to know each other.
What would you say was like some of the strongest elements of the program? The people there, just the connections you made, or?
Yeah, definitely the connections that I made. I've almost everybody that I've worked with has been through NYU grad film.
And while you were there, were you just always sort of talking to people, trying to produce their stuff?
Well, so it was structured in some way. So like you were put into groups. And so then, you know, you produced or you did whatever with the people that were in your group. But then as you moved on in the program, you could choose who you wanted to work with. And I, from the very beginning, was already like eyeing who I was interested in. Mm. So then when it came time for second year films, it's like your pre-thesis, I already knew who I wanted to work with.
Would you say you have a particular taste? Because looking at your IMDb, you have quite a range. I mean, Fort Tilden's not exactly mm-hmm. the writer. You've worked on a lot of shorts too. Would you say that you're very selective about the projects you want to work on in terms of a vision you have?
Mm-hmm. I am selective, and I would say left of center, I guess, is what I'm interested in. So usually I'm drawn to the filmmaker. So I've worked always with people who are writer-directors. I do have an interest in working with just directors as well, or writers and then attaching directors. But so far, it's just been, I've been drawn to filmmakers that are bold in some way.
Did you also, of course, meet Chloe Zhao in
at NYU? In the same class.
I guess, generally speaking, what do you think makes a great director-producer relationship?
See, because it's so different with different filmmakers. They, you know, they need different things. Appreciation of what each person is doing, communication, and a shared vision of the film itself, and also like where you want it to go.
And anything specific that you feel has made your collaboration with Chloe so special?
Well, Chloe is just, she works in a very, very non-traditional way. And, but we sort of like grew up together into it, discovered it together. And actually doing Nomadland was the first time of like bringing other people into our circle. Chloe knows exactly what she wants. And I know that I need to give her options because things can change like day to day, moment to moment. And so, for example, you know, she might wake up in the morning and think, and the sunlight is not what she wants it to be for that particular scene. So we have to be flexible and know that, like, okay, well, we can go to this location. They're flexible. You know, in the case of Nomadland, where we actually had an art department, they would need to be already prepared, even if it wasn't, you know, what they thought was going to happen that day. But just, yeah, being able to just, actually, it's a lot of producing on the fly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like especially because of the style that she works in, do you find that what's in the script is what you wind up shooting, or how much of it is impacted by, let's just get this moment, because these are real people essentially living their lives for you on camera in a way, and just going with a documentary sort of approach to it? Or is pretty much everything in the films from the script?
Songs My Brothers Taught Me, no. The Rider, yes. And Nomadland is sort of a mix of the two. But so The Rider, you know, I was just recently going back to the script, and there is so much of it that's in there, but it's sort of, the script is like a backbone. And she knows what scenes she wants and what she wants to accomplish in those scenes, like where she wants it to land. But she lets there be some spontaneity in that. Mm. And so in that case, you know, like the writing is just sort of a place to start. But then at the same time, you know, then we discover other things, you know, that might lead us to Brady breaking a horse, you know.
When you first read the script for Songs My Brother Taught Me, what did you think? Was the vision very clear to you? Were you heavily involved with developing it?
By the time that I came onto Songs, Chloe had already gone through like the screenwriting lab at Sundance, director's lab, and it was sort of in a good place. And I did understand very much what the vision was, because I also saw some videos of Pine Ridge that she'd taken during the whole research part of it. So, however, the journey of that film is also part of what created the kind of way she works, because we had a very traditional script there. I mean, I think she had like 30 drafts. Mm. And then, and we thought that we had financing, and we were told, don't worry about it, go out to Pine Ridge, start prepping. And we had crew coming out, and like we were just about to have our AD come out, and then we found out that the money wasn't coming.
Oh, man.
So we had to send everyone home.
Wow.
And it was really, all the gray hair that I have right now is from having to do that. But I, you know, it was so sad. I mean, people had, you know, subletted their homes, turned down other jobs. So we tried to not only pay them for their time, but a little bit more in order to kind of compensate for that. But we came back home and were then asked if like we could push it a little bit more, the financiers. And at that point, we realized that like if we don't do this now, we may never do it, you know, because the actors will get older. Who knows what will happen to them? And so we made the decision to just go and do it with the money that we had. We got a little bit more money, but Chloe decided, okay, I'm going to do this like doc style. So super, super small crew, throwing away the script, keeping the concept, and then just letting the people and the place sort of tell the story.
Wow.
So I think in that sense, it really was what informed
her future style. Yeah. That's so crazy. It's a bunch of cliche, but you know, a door closes, a window opens. You never know how the universe is conspiring to your good, and that it may not have been as successful, perhaps, had this new vision and style been created by the circumstances that gave you all these gray hairs.
Yeah.
She has, for the record, like no gray hairs, so that's absurd. But before you started producing features, you had done a lot of shorts. Mm-hmm. And would you say that working as a producer on those shorts prepared you for your first feature, which was Faith, Love, and Whiskey?
Oh, yeah. Faith, Love, and Whiskey, though, I only really did the New York part. So that was basically like shooting a short. But definitely making shorts completely informed, making features. Of course, there's so many more things involved that you learn along the way. But I remember with the features thinking like, okay, well, it's just basically like I'm doing four shorts in a row.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Did you ever work at a production company? Do the whole like assistant intern?
I never did. And I always wondered what my life would be like if I had, because I know that there are a lot of rules maybe that I don't know, because I just kind of jumped in and tried to figure it out as I went. You know, I am glad in a sense that I jumped right in. If I'd known maybe what I was jumping into, I probably would have not jumped so quickly. But
I feel like there really is there's, I guess, infinite pathways, but it does seem like it breaks off into either you're going to go work at a production company, work your way up the ladder, become an executive. And that's one version of being a producer. And then there's what you do, which I think is way cooler and way braver, which is to just get out there and start making stuff and finding people to collaborate with. And you were able to do that, of course, because you went to NYU and made those connections. But maybe for people who don't have that opportunity, how do beginning younger producers find material and find collaborators?
It's a good question, because that's what I asked myself when I decided that I wanted to get into film. So I joined IFP. I started volunteering there. I started volunteering at, or interning, I guess, at New York Women in Film and Television. I just tried to find places where I could get into the community, because I was completely not in the community. I had been acting in some Columbia Film School shorts, and so that opened up that world for me. And I think that once you get in, I think, with the IFP and the, you know, the more established things, there are other filmmaking groups that people have made that you can find yourself and find your way into. But I knew from the start that was really what was going to be important, is just like finding a way into the community.
So would you basically go to these events and, you know, with business cards and go up to people and say, hey, I'm a producer. What are you working on? Do you have a website? How do you, what's the organic way, I guess, to have that happen?
Well, if I were to give myself advice for back then, I would have said, do that.
Okay.
I just kind of went in and was just trying to just get it all in, you know, just absorb it all. I quickly, though, went to grad school. So, and in that case, I did meet other filmmakers that weren't necessarily in my class by going to the local bar after school or in the, like, the common areas, and just being open to talking to people as a regular person too.
Just living life and making connections.
Yeah, yeah. Like I find that the people that I've worked best with are the people that I can just have a normal conversation with, and it isn't as like formal.
So those initial years sort of outside of grad school, did you sort of hit the ground running with shorts and features, or was there a gap, and how did you manage that period right after school?
Right after school, I guess I started right away to work on features, but I could never have done that if I didn't have student loans. I continued to have student loans to support me for the 2 years that we were given for our thesis in grad school. I think now it's only 1 year. And I think I stretched it to 3 years, and I would never have been able to have financially taken on those first features if I didn't have that, because I would have had to try and find work to make money and not be able to go out to Pine Ridge for months.
Do you find that it's still difficult as an indie producer to
survive? I mean, it's only as of recently that I can actually, you know, make a living as a producer. But, you know, there were some very, very difficult years there of trying to get into the door of like producing commercials. A lot of people do that. I did a few like industrial type things. I started bookkeeping because I had to teach myself how to for the films anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I started bookkeeping for a small production company. And then at one point, Game Changer Films, which was the first equity fund to finance exclusively female directors, their films, narrative films. They were looking for someone to take the place of someone who was going on a leave for it ended up being a little over a year that I was there. And that was like my first consistent job where you have an office. Prior to that, I never, and I do not like offices. I don't like to have to be somewhere at a certain time unless it's set.
Sure.
But that was a really great experience because it was consistent pay, but I had the opportunity to put on the investor lenses for the first time. And so, you know, what I was doing was I was not only like managing books and things like that, but all of the projects coming in and part of the green lighting process. And so I was looking at projects not only to see if they, you know, were they good scripts and good director, a good team, but also does this film have a chance in the marketplace? Does the budget fit where it would go into the marketplace? So it really was, it informed a lot of the ways that I assess projects now.
Can you talk about sort of the different ways that indie films are funded and what your role is with each portion mm-hmm. of that?
So for the first few films, like She's Lost Control was almost all crowdfunding. And I was very, very involved in that. And Fort Tilden was a student loan. So that was their decision to do that. I don't think NYU allows people to do that anymore, but they made it work. You know, yeah. I'm sure they paid off their student loans. And then Songs was a combination of a lot of grants. We were really fortunate to have a lot of institutions really support the film, and crowdfunding. And, you know, we had a really hard time raising equity for that film because, you know, people looked at it and thought like, who's the audience for this? And so, you know, same thing actually with The Rider, hard to raise the funding for that.
Wow.
And so we actually had this financier who eventually came on later who said like, it's too much of a risk now, but go and make it and then come back. So we made it for super, Whoa. Super cheap.
Yeah.
And then came back and then they came with finishing funds. And actually on Songs, the financier that we initially had for that came back on for post. Then in Swallow was all equity financing.
Okay.
And Nomadland was a negative pickup.
And so in terms of your role with all of those categories, could you talk about, as most people will probably do if they're just getting out of school and making their first feature or even shorts, they're going to go to crowdfunding. What did you learn in all your times doing that that might be able to help them have a successful campaign?
Well, it's something that takes a lot of planning ahead of time. You know, you want to plan out like your messaging and kind of when you're going to message. Like once you get to this amount of money, you're going to message with this thing. There was a lot of research done to sort of find a way to spread contacts outward from just the people that we know.
Mm-hmm.
So finding like with She's Lost Control, there was a point there where we were going to have a song composed by The Strokes.
Oh, cool.
And we're able to like find fans of his that then put money in.
Got it. So sort of finding those key launch pads or hooks that you think might appeal to the greatest number of people and then just capitalizing on them as much as possible.
Yes. But I would say too, though, that like it's very difficult to extend beyond your core group of people. And so when you're figuring out how much money you want to raise, only think about who you know and how much you think that they're going to put in. And also with Kickstarter, where you can, you know, you have to make the amount or you lose it all,
mm-hmm.
be prepared to be able to have like a quarter of it that you put in yourself.
Right. Yeah, definitely. What about working with investors? Do you have a Rolodex of people that you go to? Did you start off with happening to know a lot of wealthy people?
No, I started out not knowing anyone. And that's kind of why the projects were funded by crowdfunding and grants. But it's just been over time that I have met financiers, either through programs like Film Independent Fast Track or IFP Week, or I did a couple years ago the Sundance Catalyst Forum. And so a combination of that, these organizations that are connecting me to people, and then projects that end up being, you know, getting some sort of success, then that kind of opens the door to meeting other people, whether like at a film festival or something like that. And I also just will cold email people as well.
Yeah, that's the best.
And also Game Changer. When I was at Game Changer, that also I was seeing projects coming in different production companies, and I, you know, kept a list for myself.
And what about advice for people that are applying for grants and, you know, competitions and initiatives and things like that? How do they stand out?
Yeah, I think that the way to stand out with grants is knowing why you want to make that film. Like, why is it important that you make that film? And why, and you specifically.
Would you be filling out those applications, or would that be the filmmaker?
It would be the filmmaker, but we would be working together.
Got it.
I guess there are some where there, we just did one for SF Film where there was a producer statement that we had to create, but usually it's all about the filmmaker. But as a producer, you know, you're helping to put that together.
Basically making sure that the personal is so strong. But what about like the why now? You know, That's important too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The urgency of it. Why does this have to be made now? Is it relevant?
And then now, as you are more established, are you optioning things personally? Are you trying to get things to various production companies maybe you have an alliance with? Or what is it like when you're not actively working on a film, I guess?
I'm developing projects. So I have two projects that are in the early writing stage. Like, one of them isn't even in outline stage yet, but it's just like batting around ideas with the filmmaker. One of them, we made a short and now she's developing into a feature. So I'm, reading drafts, giving notes, and kind of also at the same time, when I talk to financiers or production companies, letting them know that those things are
happening,
going to be coming, coming soon. I do want to look more actively for IP. I think that's definitely something that can give a producer more power, basically agency, if you own the project.
At times I've thought about hiring my high school literature teachers and just saying, hey, if you see anything that's not on the New York Times bestseller, would you let me know? Because I'll pay you to find it for me, because there's only so much time in the day.
Yeah. There was one point where I was like, I'm going to find my next story in This American Life. And then it's so funny that then The Farewell. And I'm sure there's probably a lot of films that have come out of This American Life. Well, but now I think it's more people know about
it. Yeah, it's catching on.
Exactly.
And the person who caught that was someone that I worked briefly with at Big Beach, Danny Melia, who's also an NYU alum.
Cool.
Yeah, so she did that. That was a beautiful film that
it
just
was
came out.
So beautiful.
Can you talk a little bit about when you are developing a script with a director? How do you approach it in the sense of this is their film? You're trying to empower and encourage them, but you may also have strong opinions or things you're concerned about. How do you approach working with them?
Well, I think it's always a learning process, like the best way to talk to a writer. But I try to understand what it is that the writer is really trying to say, and then helping them find the best way to say that. So if there's a scene that's not quite working, or if there's a character maybe that's not quite working, you know, I try to approach it from like kind of the inside out. Mm-hmm. It can get a little bit harder when we're moving more toward like trying to budget something, and then having to way me being like, you just have too many characters that are speaking. or too many locations. And I learned something interesting from Joe Wright, the filmmaker, was our EP on Swallow. And he was working with Carlo, the writer-director. And they had one meeting where then after that meeting, Carlo was cutting all the locations that I wanted to have cut.
Oh.
I was like, what is it that he said? I need to learn this. And what he had said was, he was like, Carlo, time is your commodity. And, you know, if you're traveling all these company moves, going to this location, that location, you're not having time to direct your actors. And that really clicked for him.
Mm. Yeah, that is a good note. You kind of get inside their minds and find what motivates them specifically. So especially now when you're working on Nomadland, which I think is probably the biggest production you've worked on, how do you sort of define roles when there are many producers on a project?
Funny enough, though, like Nomadland had fewer crew members, though, than Swallow, for example, because of the nature of the way that she works, you need to be as small and invisible as possible. But the different roles with producers, it's definitely important to identify them early on. Like with Swallow, I brought Manette on because I knew that I needed her expertise. With Nomadland, that project actually came to Chloe. And then she brought me on because she knew that I knew how to produce her weird films.
Yeah.
but then there were, you know, Dan Janvey was also a producer on it, and he was in many ways the liaison with Fox Searchlight. And then Peter Spears was a producer on that too. He came with the material, and with Frances McDormand, they got the rights to that book together. But yeah, and from the beginning, it was identified, like, knowing that I was like the production lead.
So just make sure you define it, and then everyone sort of falls into their place and generally, hopefully.
Right. But it's always, you know, it was interesting with Swallow, because like Manette also has a strong production background, but we did specifically identify early on that we were going to do that, and it was really helpful.
Can you talk a bit about working with your friends? And it seems like it is going very well for you, but have you ever had experiences where when that friendship sort of impacts negatively a professional setting like a film and how you dealt with it?
Maybe there's never. Always going to be emotions when you're making a film. And, you know, when you're making the film with friends, you kind of know that, like, for example, with Chloe, I feel in a way like she's a sister, and there's always going to be a bond there that won't break. But, you know, emotions can get high, frustrations can get high. But I try and communicate about whatever it is. But I'm also very good at compartmentalizing and just putting something away and moving on.
Yeah, well, that's good. Especially if you're the leader of the shoots, you're a role model for everybody else. It's important to remember. Do you have a certain structure, you personally, in terms of what your expectations are or protections that you have for yourself going into various productions?
Boundaries, kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I guess ways to prevent being taken advantage of in any particular way. Contracts, even with your friends when you're making things. Mm-hmm. It's just because I've noticed sort of a trend where you work with your friends, and there's, of course, hopefully a great dynamic between you. But as things develop and get bigger, and you don't have contracts and you don't have things between you that are defining your expectations personally, I was just wondering if as a freelance producer, you kind of walk around with, this is what I am willing to do, what I'm not willing to do, get paid, all of that sort of at the ready.
I probably should, but I do not. I am
very
much.
You're just lucky.
I'm just very much like a handshake. I spend time like figuring out if I instinctually trust this person. I probably too much go by my gut, and there have definitely been projects where I've developed them for like over a year and then walked away for one reason or another, didn't get paid, you know. But I kind of see it as that development period, you know, if you could be so lucky to have some sort of like, you know, overhead deal, first look deal or something. But, you know, I probably should have contracts early on, but I don't. And I kind of remember John Tintori talking about that at grad film, because he came up in the like John Sayles world, and it was a lot of friends all working together. And he felt the same way I did, that like, you kind of just jump in. But as a producer, I probably shouldn't do that.
Okay. Let's talk about Fort Tilden for a little bit. It's such a funny film. It's so unique, such unlikable characters, but it really is sending a clear message. What did you think of the script when you first got it? What were your initial thoughts?
Well, that is an interesting one because I came on, I had always wanted to produce for SV and Charles. I thought they were really wonderful. However, when they were wanting to make that film, I was in South Dakota prepping Songfair Brothers Taught Me. So I actually wasn't a part of the production of it.
Oh, okay.
I came on, in post, I came on, they wanted to meet with me to ask me, like, what are the next steps? What do we do? And so I started advising them and I, you know, and I was like, can I see a cut? And then I went home and I watched it and I was like, this is special. And I started to compose an email to them to say that I wanted to produce, you know, post-produce it basically. And I remember like going to my mentor at the time and saying, and asking her advice. And I was like, you know, I feel like I can't ask for money though, because I've never post-produced anything. I've never delivered anything. And she advised me, as she always and continues to, make sure that I get paid.
So you do have a little bit of a plan.
Yeah. Okay. So as I was composing that email to them, I got an email from them asking me to produce it.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. So that was an interesting one because I, you know, there were a lot of things in production that hadn't been done, like contracts and with crew and things like that. There was no legal at the time when they went into production. So I was kind of retroactively doing those things and then working on the festival strategy, who and this was all the first time. And so, you know, who's going to sell it, who's going to be the publicist, and then finally delivering it to MGM Orion was, you know, their delivery schedule was huge, and just going through that and learning for the first time.
Can you talk a little bit about your hour by hour role at a film festival? Because your films have gone to Sundance and Tribeca and Cannes and South by Southwest. So as the producer, obviously you're there to get distribution, but what do you do at the actual festivals to help that process?
Well, Tribeca, you have a sales agent, and so, you know, you're in contact with them, hearing, you know, what feedback might be from distributors that have come. Tribeca is difficult, though, to get, same with South By, to get distributors to attend. So a lot of times they'll send their juniors, and then it'll be like about the follow-up. Your sales agents will do that, though, not the producer. The follow-up of has your senior watched it yet, you know, and it's very, very frustrating. And then with Sundance, like with songs, our financier was our sales agent. That was a very disappointing experience because we just like did not get any attention. And we brought out the actors. So in a lot of ways, I was also like
taking care of them.
Yeah. And we brought them out to Cannes too. And in that case, we already had a distributor in France, and our, you know, in the international sales was already doing their thing. And, you know, Chloe's off doing her interviews, or, you know, the director is off doing interviews. And I think it's just like maintaining communication with the sales agents and hearing what the lay of the land is.
In essence, it can be anything. It's always changing. Sometimes you're taking care of actors. Sometimes you're, you know, focusing on the deal, et cetera. Handing out postcards, maybe come see my film.
Don't waste your money on postcards.
Don't waste your money. Do you hear that? Don't waste your money on postcards. That's generally like the first thing people do.
Postcards and posters. Don't. I mean, because the distributor will end up making their own poster anyway.
Do you have a favorite phase of making a film? Do you love development? Do you love being on set, being in the editing room?
I love being on set.
And when you're there as a producer, are you also in a lot of these indie films doing line producing, basically, or
not as much anymore? So on Swallow, I was very much by the monitor. On Nomadland, I had a line producer in UPM, but because we were so small, I was in a lot of ways still. I was many times location scout and manager. So in that case, yeah, I was still doing a lot of like hands-on things, but like the project that I'm working on next, I will be hiring line producers, and they'll do it much better than me anyway.
When you're working, for instance, on songs and the writer, now you also come from an acting background, and I feel like there is a big trend with indies in particular where they want non-actors playing these roles. Why do you think that is? And is there anything that trained actors can learn from non-actors?
Yeah. And actually this one I'm doing with Joe, this is the main character is a non-actor. I was always so surprised with the non-actors, how they were just naturally able to be themselves in imaginary circumstances, like something that actors, you know, train all their lives to do. And I mean, not all of the non-actors were able to do that, but the ones that that Chloe found or the one that Joe has found have that in them. And they're just listening and they're responding. They're listening and responding. And so I think that's
the lesson for actors, is to maybe let all that technique and craft go a little bit more maybe, and just try to be present and listen as themselves as much as possible.
Yeah.
But you were just working with Frances McDormand, so she's one of my favorites.
She's amazing. Can
you give us a little anything about the way that she works?
She's wonderful. Inquisitive. I think there's a learning curve that had to happen there, because a lot of times Chloe's kind of like right nearby, crouched down and throwing out lines or saying to the non-actor, like, oh, remember the story that you told me? Tell Frances. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was like that was something that she probably had to get to adjust to. And there also wasn't really a script. Okay. But yeah, I mean, she's so naturally, there was never a moment where it did not seem authentic. And I think that's just her training and experience. I mean, she fit right in. So did David Strathairn, who's also in the film.
Right, right. Did you ever have complications with Brady or Johnny in terms of this is their actual lives and maybe trying to control what you guys were doing with the film because it maybe didn't align with their truth?
With John in Songs, it really wasn't his life at all. He was playing a character. I mean, they had like qualities of him, but he's actually a much more goofy, fun guy than that contemplative character. And with Brady, you know, it was, you know, specifically his story. You know, not all of that is true, but, like there were moments, I think, where he would say to Chloe, like, well, I would do it this way. Like I would put the saddle on from this direction. And she was like, well, sure, but the sun looks better if it's over here. And so he'd just have to adjust to that. But I think, you know, he's talked about how like shooting that was also him coming to terms with what has happened to him as well, because it wasn't so much after the accident that he was in the film.
Why do you think The Rider had such an impact on Barack Obama, Barry Jenkins, Michael Keaton? What is it about that film that you think just struck a chord with people?
I think what Brady was going through is something that that we all can relate to, you know, where you have this dream of something who, you know, you have this idea of who you are, and then suddenly something happens and it makes you question everything about how you defined yourself. And you know, the combination in that film of not only the practicality of how do I live if that's what I do, but then also just as an individual of what is my identity. I think it's just a universal struggle that everybody at some point finds themselves in. But I think someone was just saying this to me about The Rider, but I hadn't realized it, I think, because I was so inside of it. But that when you're watching the movie and you it starts out where you think it's like, you know, you might like actors or non-actors, but they're you know, doing a script or whatever. But then when you get to the scene where he breaks the horse, suddenly realize that this is a real person. And then it just makes all of the stakes a little higher because it's the idea of being paralyzed. It's real.
How big was your crew on The Rider?
There were 6 of us.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's it. Actually, and like, how long was the shoot?
Like a month and a half.
Wow.
Yeah. It was Chloe, the DP, the gaffer, who was also the key grip and also the first AC, the second AC, who was also the DIT, sound, who also boomed, and me.
That is indie filmmaking at its finest.
But it's also like you want to be small and flexible and fluid to be able to just run around and make these.
Absolutely. Can you tell us about a film where maybe you learned a big lesson, or maybe it was a difficult experience and you took home something from that that changed the way you proceeded in the future?
When you're crewing up, I made the mistake with a crew member where it was between two people, and one of them seemed less confident, more cautious, and the other one seemed really confident and relaxed. And we went with that person. And confidence does not equal competence. So the person that we didn't go with later on, we worked with, and then realized that the reason why she was cautious was because she was really thinking about, like, does this budget work, you know? And whereas the other person just kind of like crammed it in and said, yeah, we can do it. And then not necessarily, we were able to do it budget wise, but there was just that confidence does not equal competence.
And don't judge a book by its cover.
Yeah.
But how could you have known that that would have been the case until you started working together anyway? I mean,
you know, you try as much as you can to talk to other people that have worked with a crew member before you've worked with them. And with that one, we probably should have tried to talk to more people.
Any sort of key near the end of this conversation advice for young producers?
Stay in the community, you know, continue to see films and connect with filmmakers. If you're the kind of producer like me that gravitates toward writer-directors, make those connections, because that's your currency in a way. Something I would also add, though, too, is to befriend other producers, because there are producers that we all will reach out to one another by email or whatever to get advice, not only just to hear, you know, how did you like working with this person, but, you know, advice, but also just somebody who you can have like a sounding board, because it can be very frustrating and a lonely life as a producer. So having other producers that you can talk to is super important. But also giving back, I think, is hugely important. And in any way, at any level that you're in, because even when I was less experienced, if there's always someone less experienced than you, being able to help people along the way, I think is really important, because that person might be your partner.
And do you have any resources, could be books or videos or poems, whatever, that it would be great for younger artists to take advantage of or read?
Yeah, there's a new blog, a newsletter called Dear Producer that Rebecca Green puts together. It's like a monthly, you sign up, it's a monthly newsletter. And basically she scours all of the trades and collects all of the most the articles that she thinks are important to read. And sometimes she breaks them down and discusses them, and she also just lists them. It's a really great resource. She does the work for you.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Any others? Maybe you would say, like, if you're lucky to live in these areas, join IFP.
Mm-hmm.
Film
Independent, being a part of their programs. I was part of the Film Independent Producing Lab, and yeah, just get involved and be a part of the community.
Yeah, join those programs that are normally pretty inexpensive, if not free, and you get a bunch of education. And
yeah, I mean, with IFP, if you volunteer for IFP week for like the whole time or something, you get a free year membership.
Oh, awesome!
I used to be their volunteer coordinator.
Oh, cool.
So I was the one that was getting people to all come work for free.
That's
great. Is now what I do as a producer.
Yeah. Well, this has been amazing, and you're such an inspiring person, and so is the work that you make, and I'm really grateful for it and for this conversation. So with that, it was great to see you.
Great to see you.
Thanks
too.
For
Thank
doing
you.
This.
It's fun.
And that's a wrap with Molly Asher. Thank you, everyone, for giving us a listen. And if you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. It really does mean a lot to us. Also, be sure to follow our Instagram at Movie Mentors Podcast, as we'll be releasing special bonus content from this interview with Molly and behind-the-scenes goodies on there. This episode was edited by Kevin Thomas Keeling, music by Gabe Sokolov. Be well, everybody, and thanks for tuning in.